again, as the film shows, really a large number of people have gone straight from working for the Zionist entity into effectively working for the British taxpayer. Mm-hmm. And really, given all of the concerns that have been expressed in this programme on many occasions, we're seeing a penetration, essentially, into the very fabric of British governance of operatives of the Zionist regime.
Mm. I mean, Mick, what do you make of the British government using public money to fund the expansion of Israeli economic interests in the UK? I mean, as I said in the introduction there, the former British government minister, Matt Hancock, simply described it as just a different way of doing diplomacy.
Thanks for having me, Chris. By the way, I'm no longer chair of the campaign. I'm still on the National Committee. This is some job creation programme. It would be great if they would do some job creation programmes like this in the UK, where it's greatly needed. But good wages, and they're working out at a British embassy to facilitate trade with Israel. Now, Israel often manages to offload the costs of its own efforts. Palestinian prisoners actually often have to pay for their own food. So this comes as shocking, but it's not surprising that this is the situation. It's part of 100% full spectrum complicity between the British state and the Israeli state, diplomatic, political, military. But I have to say, this still comes as a shock. Wow, what a job creation programme, Chris.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I mean, David, I mean, is it possible, do you think, that these contracts are being used simply as a sort of data grab for the Israeli intelligence?
Well, the link with intelligence is of course, one which is not surprising and which comes out, of the attempts from some years ago of the Netanyahu government to send people from Israeli intelligence organizations, in particular the Signals Intelligence Unit, Unit 8200, mm-hmm. into the tech startups. Now, they're foreseen as sort of emissaries of the Zionist regime. So it's not, these are not just people who've gone off into business. These are people who are intended by the regime to carry the interests of the Israeli state into the startups that they're engaged in. And that's part of the whole genesis of this strategy of startup nation that the Israelis are always going on about. This is partly about foreign policy aims and objectives as well as simply business objectives.
Mm. Mick, how does a project like this impact, do you think, on the effectiveness of the boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign?
Well, it's very clearly aimed to defeat it as far as it possibly can. I mean, the interesting thing about one of the Glasgow initiatives to deploy an Israeli military-grade surveillance system in central Glasgow, by the way, as a pilot, which if it goes ahead is not challenged, might be deployed in other UK cities. The key thing about it is that it had to be done in the dark. There was no public debate. There was nothing on Glasgow City Council. There was nothing in the Scottish Parliament. It was kept very, very silent indeed before that system was deployed. So they know that it's very, very unpopular. They know that if there were a widespread public conversation, how many people in Glasgow would actually agree to have technology deployed on their city streets with emotional recognition software, which can pick up on you if you're having a bad day and then follow you around the city, bring in all your social media posts and decide if you're a person of interest to Police Scotland. I think the Israelis know, the British also are well aware, that Israel is deeply unpopular and that these operations have to be surrounded by a cloud. They can't be done. They can't be dragged out into the open because they do not enjoy public support. There is no mandate for the examples that I know of, and to date, even though this technology was deployed 8-9 years ago, there has still been no public debate on the topic, and I've yet to meet anyone in Glasgow who approves, not of CCTV. I mean, CCTV can be used to find murderers. It's been quite useful on some occasions, but this kind of highly intrusive Israeli military-grade surveillance, which locks onto demonstrations, identifies people of interest, and even identifies ordinary Glaswegians going about their business, and then decides to dig very deeply into their into their private life. It raises very fundamental questions, not just about transparency or the complete lack of it. It raises fundamental questions about the right to a private life. Perhaps that's one of the reasons why it's it is dealt with so, I think, furtively.
Yeah. Well, David, tell us about Britain's role in establishing the Israeli military in the first place.
Well, we did a show on this a while ago, and there was this Irish guy who was involved in setting up the Jewish Legion, which was fought in the British military, indeed fought in Jerusalem. And amongst its leaders was the revisionist Zionist, Vladimir Jabotinsky, changed his name later to Zev Jabotinsky, one of the leaders of the organization which became the Irgun, the terror gang, which was involved, in, of course, in bombing British soldiers and officers, and indeed in the massacres of Arab and Palestinian civilians. So this organization was the kind of the kernel of what became the IDF, the Jewish Legion, and the British Army. So the British Army effectively, organizationally set up the IDF, even though in its birth the Irgun and other Zionist terror gangs were involved actually in committing terrorism against the British Empire. But you know, that's the origin of the IDF.
Very interesting. Mick, just a reminder, will you, about Britain's part in developing Israeli apartheid during the Mandate period as well?
Well, David's mentioned the military side of it. Can I just add a little tidbit, horrific though? Matthew Hughes in the Journal of Imperial History has an article about how the British brutalised Jewish troops during the Mandate. Now, that doesn't mean how Israeli troops brutalised Palestinians by beating and smashing them up. What he meant was that British troops like Wingate and others trained Israeli soldiers in the methods of counterinsurgency, attacking civilians, attacking innocent villages that had been perfected throughout the British Empire. Look, Israel's a species of colonialism, actually settler colonialism. You can't have that without a species of apartheid. I mean, on a clear day, you can look from Scotland to Northern Ireland, and over there, we still have, despite the end of the war, we still have walls between communities.
Yes.
Britain deliberately divided communities against each other, and in Palestine, they did so on steroids.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that, Mick. We're just going to pause there for a moment. This report now on how Israeli firms are penetrating the National Health Service in the UK.
The UK Israel Tech Hub is a body through which Israel pursues its economic and digital interest in Britain. But is it serving other interests related to espionage? Here, the former director of the organization, Aidan Fisher, can barely conceal his glee that the British taxpayer is funding the integration of the Israeli and British economies.
So the Hub is a very unique initiative. It's actually funded by the British government. We're based at the embassy in Tel Aviv, just opposite the Hilton Hotel. Actually, the stage in which we operate, a lot of the time the money actually flows from the UK to Israel. We find ourselves helping Israeli companies, especially if they're in their seed or round A stage, because we have an interest. Our interest is to increase the stickiness, to increase the ties between the UK and Israel.
Palestine Declassified previously revealed the 2012 Netanyahu policy of moving agents of Israeli military intelligence, Unit 8200, into private companies to continue their work. Is the UK-Israel Tech Hub a vehicle for that? It should be disconcerting for British taxpayers to note that the British embassy-backed project has been integral to the signing of a memorandum of understanding between Israel and the Northern Health Services Alliance to facilitate the expansion of the Israeli tech industry into the NHS. Through the tech hub, something called the UK-Israel Health Tech Gateway has been established, which will give Israeli tech companies access to vast swathes of health data on British citizens. The UK-Israel Tech Hub has been extensively supported by previous subjects of the Palestine Declassified Investigation, British Telecom and Mishkon Derea. This is all symptomatic of a much wider push at economic, digital and intelligence integration between Britain and Israel, as outlined in a research paper for the largest Israel lobby group in the country, BICOM. The paper even seems to ominously imply that the British ambassador to Israel may have been cultivated by the Zionists, stating, "The UK and Israeli national strategies for addressing cyber challenges have developed in parallel with acknowledged cross-fertilization between them. It is perhaps no coincidence that former UK ambassador to Israel, Matthew Gold, returned from his posting in Tel Aviv in 2015 to become director of cybersecurity at the UK Cabinet Office. The document also asserts that the UK's National Security Establishment's programme Cyber Discovery, which grooms children into cybersecurity professionals, on the Maximum programme in Israeli school. The Maximum is the infamous Unit 8200 school programme that cultivates children to be Israeli spies. The level of digital integration between Israel and Britain has reached unprecedented levels, with an anonymous senior British official describing Israel as a first-order partner in cybersecurity. It would seem wise to wonder what data former Israeli spies have access to through such integration.
David, what do you make of this BICOM paper that lays out extensive digital collaboration between Britain and Israel?
Well, integration is the word that they're using, and it does seem to be a really very significant melding between British activities and Israeli activities. And of course, these are not just business activities, these are also, as we've seen in the film there, activities which have an intelligence component or an intelligence interest. So the involvement there in the health tech hub, for example, very worrying that Israeli tech firms staffed by people from formerly in Israeli intelligence agencies are able to get access to data in the British National Health Service. Now, you know, the National Health Service is seen by everyone in this country as being a massive achievement, but are we really opening up the access, the data in the NHS to Israeli startups and indeed possibly to Israeli intelligence organizations? Can that really be the idea that most people have of what the NHS is for?
Well, Mick, I mean, Idan Fisher, the former director of the UK-Israel Tech Hub, can barely contain himself when asked about British funding. I mean, is this what state capture looks like, do you think?
It's a quid pro quo. Israel makes itself very useful to Britain and to the West in general. I mean, one Israeli prime minister described Israel as disgusting language, a villa in the jungle. Herzl himself said it was an outpost of European civilization among savages of a sort. So Israel's there as an extension, a crusader state, if you like, which can be called upon, if need be, to deal with anyone who stands up to Western diktat. So I'm not surprised that the integration is so close. Now, your viewers may even know about Jonathan Pollard. Jonathan Pollard was an American who actually stole container loads of American secrets and delivered them to Israel, for which he was given a life sentence, released recently. Of course Israel will use this access in order to steal data. That's what states do. The problem is, and it's a very pressing problem, is that the surveillance system I've already alluded to in Glasgow, it is sold on the strength of massive surveillance and then rapid integration of the individual who's identified with their social media posts. But even there, health data was deemed to be off limits. Now, once they get access to health data, then all sorts of blackmail becomes possible. And you have to remember that 43 Israeli soldiers, and they were, you know, they were Zionists, resigned from the unit that's mothered all this technology because it was used in order to surveil and blackmail Palestinians. This is malign technology. And once it gets access, it breaks the barrier into medical data. Yeah. Then the warning issued by those Israeli soldiers that it can be used to blackmail, intimidate, force people to collaborate, force people to change their political behavior becomes even more serious. So I think this information that you're uncovering is very, very significant for British people.
Yeah. Well, David, tell us why Unit 8200, the Israeli intelligence corps, is relevant to this conversation then.
Well, so, I mean, it's relevant in many ways. First of all, what we've already been saying, which is the travelling of people who used to be in this Israeli intelligence agency into tech startups and therefore into the corporate world where they can get access to data. But also this Mag Shamim program, where they have this training program essentially to groom children to become Israeli intelligence agents. And that program itself has been taken over and transposed by GCHQ in this country to bring kids into the intelligence services here. Wow. So we have a parallel there as well. And that's not the end of it. I mean, this is really a problem about the many ways in which Israeli intelligence are able to access data in this country. Mick's talking about the surveillance program, there's the health question, and then of course there's the involvement, as we've seen in the previous program, of Patrick Drahi, the Zionist billionaire, who's now the largest single stakeholder, shareholder in British Telecom. Yeah. So there's a really significant issue here of multiple sources of data available to Israeli intelligence over almost all British citizens.
Mm. Well, Mick, I mean, what do you think the ramifications of the UK-Israel health tech gateway could actually be then?
Now, look, people joke that most countries, most states have an army, but the Israeli army has a state. What they mean is that the military so saturates and penetrates every aspect of the Israeli economy, political and social life, that you can't divide them off. And when these tech companies get an entry into British economic life, into the health service, for example, you're giving it to the Israeli military. Now, we remember that Huawei was supposed to be stripped out of its core functions in the British telecommunications structures because it could be used by the Communist Party. I mean, we were told that we had to be wary of TikTok because the Chinese Communist Party could use it. It became ridiculous. But it's not ridiculous to say that the Israeli security establishment will be directing these capitalists, will be directing these industrialists, and these industrialists will have no freedom of maneuver compared to the Israeli security establishment. So, yes, they've already got themselves a significant position in the UK pharmaceutical industry. You know, the pharmacy industry, where something called Teva supplies a lot of pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
It, once again, that's all done behind the scenes. Nobody, if it were called Israeli drugs, nobody would buy them, but it's already there significantly. So, yeah, it's very worrying. It's very worrying.
Well, David, tell us about this Mag Shamim program in Israeli schools and its application in Britain.
So, I mean, as I was saying, I mean, this program is about grooming children to become intelligence agents. And they go through hacker training programs and competitions. And there are hacker competitions. One of the guys who set up the Wix company, WIX, one of the startups there, he was a previous winner of an internal Unit 8200 hacking program where he hacked into the computers of three hostile states. Now we don't know which ones they were, but we can imagine which ones they were. Mm. And he went on then to form this web company. People still have websites on the Wix using the Wix software. And the same thing's been happening in the UK. There, GCHQ runs competitions like that. And there's the integration, which is the worrying thing. For example, the guy who was the ambassador in Tel Aviv, Matthew Gould, who went on to become the director of cybersecurity in the cabinet office. And of course, his next job after that was to be involved with the cyber work in tech work in the health service.
Yes.
So he was actually overseeing the Israeli involvement in the health service technology. So that's a really significant problem there.
Are there any other similar examples, you think, like Matthew Gould? Or, I mean, was he a one-off?
Well, there's an integration increasingly between the interests of the Israelis and parts of the government apparatus in this country. So Gould is one example. There are many other examples of people who are effectively operating for the interests of the Israelis inside the governmental apparatus in Whitehall and in Westminster.
Oh, very interesting. Well, I'm afraid that we're out of time today. I hope you found the programme informative again. I want to thank our guests, Mick Napier, and our resident expert, of course, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, This is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme.
In the limelight. In the US, a military budget of $858 billion for 2023, a 4.6% increase in the salaries of soldiers, the budget for the purchase of weapons, ships and aircraft, support for Taiwan against China, and support for Ukraine against Russia is predicted. U.S. lawmakers agreed to provide another security aid worth at least $800 million to Ukraine next year and bolster Taiwan with $2 billion in aid over the coming years. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Defense News website has more for us. The House on Thursday, 8th of December, passed a massive $858 billion 2023 National Defense Authorization Act in a vote of 350-80, sending the bill to the Senate, where a vote is expected to be held in the coming days. The $858 billion National Defense Authorization Act is $45 billion more than President Joe Biden asked for, marking the second year in a row that U.S. Congress made the military budget higher than what the White House had requested. The amount represents an 8% increase from the 2022 National Defense Authorization Act, which was finalized at $782 billion. The 2023 National Defense Authorization Act dropped amendments added to the House of Representatives version that would have restricted weapons sales to countries accused of human rights abuses. Such provisions were included in the House version of the National Defense Authorization Act, but didn't make it passed into the final version that was negotiated with the Senate. Notable amendments packed into the National Defense Authorization Act include a measure that will give the Pentagon wartime purchasing powers by allowing non-competitive multi-year contracts for certain arms. The authority could be used to refill U.S. stockpiles, arm Ukraine, and assist foreign governments that have provided support for Ukraine. The list of munitions the Pentagon is allowed to procure using the purchasing power is extensive and includes the HIMARS rocket launch system, 155mm ammunition, Javelin anti-tank missiles, Stinger anti-aircraft missiles, Harpoon anti-ship missiles, and much more. U.S. weapons manufacturers will benefit greatly from the new authority, especially Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, as many of their systems are on the list. The multi-year contracts will incentivize the arms makers to significantly ramp up production. Ukraine will receive $800 million in the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative from the National Defense Authorization Act, a program that allows the U.S. government to purchase weapons for Ukraine. But the vast majority of spending on the Ukraine conflict will come through emergency funding, and the White House is hoping Congress approves a new $37.7 billion tranche of Ukraine aid during the lame duck period. The National Defense Authorization Act includes $11.5 billion in new investments for the Pacific Deterrence Initiative, a program to build up in the Asia-Pacific region to confront China. The Pentagon has identified China as its main focus, and the National Defense Authorization Act includes investments in new technology research and development that U.S. military leaders say is meant to counter Beijing. The anti-war website has also covered the same story. The 2023 National Defense Authorization Act includes legislation that will give unprecedented U.S. military support to Taiwan, a step that Beijing will view as a major provocation and the U.S. moving further away from the One China policy. Senator Bob Menendez, a Democrat from New Jersey, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said the new support for Taiwan in the National Defense Authorization Act will dramatically enhance the United States' defense partnership with Taiwan by establishing, for the first time ever, a specific defense modernization program for Taiwan. The Taiwan Enhanced Resilience Act will authorize $2 billion in annual military aid for 5 years. The aid is in the form of foreign military financing, a State Department program that gives foreign governments money to purchase American arms. The United States has sold weapons to Taiwan since severing diplomatic relations with Taipei in 1979, but it has never financed the purchases. Under the legislation, Taiwan will be allowed to use more than 15% of the foreign military financing funding to procure weapons domestically. The Taiwan Enhanced Resilience Act includes $1 billion in annual presidential drawdown authority, which will allow the United States to send weapons to Taiwan directly from the Pentagon stockpiles. The Biden administration has sent the majority of military aid to Ukraine using this authority, and there are members of Congress who believe the United States should be arming Taiwan just as urgently. The Taiwan Enhanced Resilience Act also puts aside $100 million annually to create a regional contingency stockpile for Taiwan. Besides the funding, the legislation calls for more military cooperation between the United States and Taiwan and looks to increase Taipei's participation in international organizations. The Taiwan Enhanced Resilience Act was called the Taiwan Policy Act, a piece of legislation that was advanced by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in September. Some of the more provocative aspects of the Taiwan Policy Act were stripped out of the Taiwan Enhanced Resilience Act, including giving Taiwan the benefits of being a major non-NATO ally and requiring sanctions in the event of Chinese military operation in Taiwan. CNBC has more for us. The U.S. House has passed a massive bill to fund the Defense Department for fiscal year 2023, teeing up a final vote in the Senate in the coming days that will send the $858 billion behemoth to President Joe Biden's desk, where he's expected to sign it. Among the more than 4,000 pages of legislation is a requirement that the Pentagon drop its COVID vaccine mandate for active duty service members within 30 days of its enactment. The mandate, originally put in place last year, recently emerged as a lightning rod for conservative Republicans who threatened to sink the entire bill if it wasn't rescinded. The National Defense Authorization Act was released on Tuesday night, 6th of December, after weeks of backroom negotiations. President Biden and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin have both publicly said they oppose the provision ending the vaccine mandate. but the Democratic chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Representative Adam Smith of Washington, said on the House floor on Thursday, 8th of December, that it was the right time to end the vaccine requirement. His comment was seen as a strong signal that the White House will back the final bill. Joe Biden's press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, would not confirm or deny on Wednesday, 7th of December, that President Biden would sign the bill, instead telling reporters that Biden is going to look at the National Defense Authorization Act in its entirety and make his judgment on that. The House was initially scheduled to vote on the bill on Wednesday afternoon, 7th of December, but its procedural path through the Rules Committee was stalled after members of the Congressional Black Caucus sought to force the inclusion of the John Lewis Voting Act's right in the bill. The National Defense Authorization Act is an annual tradition in Congress where it is considered a must-pass bill because its enactment is required in order for military service members to receive their pay and benefits on time after 1st of January 2023.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing Iran's strategic naval force with the commander of Iran's Navy, Admiral Shahram Irani. But first, this brief analysis.
In the early 20th century, U.S. Navy Admiral Alfred Mahan theorized that in order for a nation to be the primary global power, it needs to control all the major naval choke points located in the world's oceans and seas. He theorized about the vital geostrategic importance of what he named, quote, the Middle East, the area that is Western Asia, and the connecting point between Asia, Africa, and Europe. His views were enthusiastically adopted by the British Empire, the dominant empire of the time, who in the wake of the decline of the Ottoman Empire began to dominate the region. This meant that no local nation was allowed to develop naval power as a rival to Britain, including Iran, which had a naval tradition going back to ancient history. The United States inherited the strategy of global naval dominance following World War II when it became the inheritor of the British Empire, including the part related to not allowing regional nations such as Iran to develop their naval capabilities. All this changed after the Islamic Revolution in Iran and the imposed war in the 1980s, which saw Iran gradually develop its navy into the strategic force that it has become today. Today, the Iranian Navy is challenging the lie spread by the U.S. Navy that it is providing so-called security in the region by providing real security in cooperation with other regional nations and advocating the expulsion of all foreign navies from the region and showing that their presence in the region is redundant. The Iranian Navy has also shown its ability to fly the flag in distant seas, from the Caribbean Sea and Latin America to the English Channel and the North Sea to the Straits of Malacca and the South China Sea. As Iran takes its place as a rising power in the post-American multipolar global order, so will its strategic naval power increase, and the world will witness its permanent naval presence in the world's oceans and seas in cooperation with its strategic partners from around the globe.
Admiral Shahram Irani, Commander of the Iranian Navy, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. As we spoke before the program, you know, our program tries to look at the current events and the events that occur in the news from a more strategic and historic perspective. In our previous programs in the past two seasons, we've talked a lot about the geostrategic plans and geostrategic different views that have existed among Western strategic planners, all the way beginning with Halford Mackinder, which were more focused on land and on issues related to the army and geo in terms of land and geostrategics. And we mentioned very briefly in some parts the marine and naval aspect of this, which at the same time as this was happening at the end of the 19th century and the 20th century, we have people like Admiral Mahan in the United States theorizing this global British, American, Anglo-American empire from a marine perspective, the idea that in order for Britain and then America as the inheritor of the British Empire following World War II, in order for them to rule the world, they have to control all the strategic choke points, marine choke points in the world, places such as the Strait of Hormuz, Bab al-Mandab in Yemen, Suez Canal, Eastern Mediterranean, the Dardanelles, the Bosphorus, Straits of Bosphorus, exactly our region of the world, the most important strategic region as they have been claiming for over 100 years. If we look at history, we see that the British and all other Western powers actually used pirates as part of their global naval strategies. The famous pirates that are maybe known in history were actually part of a larger naval strategy by the British to indirectly engage and to attack their enemies without having to suffer the consequences of having a direct naval confrontation with the rival powers that they were doing. So what you're saying is that this policy still exists today, that a lot of the things that were called Somali pirates or the pirates that existed in the northern Indian Ocean, in the Bab al-Mandab area, were actually pirates and forces that were connected to the Americans and the Western naval forces.
اینجا یه نکته ویژه وجود داره شاید پنهان خیلی بهش
There's a special point here that may be left unsaid and is not being paid much attention to. When does this happen and at what point? Where in the Indian Ocean? It happens in an area in the Indian Ocean where there is no navy. None of these countries have naval power, unfortunately. That is, you should note that from the countries on the shores of the Persian Gulf to those on the shores of the Red Sea and Suez Canal, no one has a naval power. How do you explain this situation? The message it sends out refers to the same doctrine that you mentioned. That is, they have chosen a strategy to insinuate that they are the only ones who are able to be present at the sea and bring security. That is, if the area becomes insecure, there will be no one around to come to the rescue. In that case, they can safely announce that they are the only ones who can protect and guard you. They intend to convince the countries of the region that they are the only one, that they are the only sea power available. So what happened? At that time, one of our ships was also hijacked by these pirates. That's when a new chapter in the history of the country's navy began. Since 2009, a decree was issued that the strategic navy of the Islamic Republic of Iran is responsible for the security of our shipping and the task of protecting the economic artery of the country.
Do I understand you correctly? So we're talking about the security of all ships in that area. It's not only about the Iranian ships that would be coming and going. Of course, they have the priority, but in a way, Iran is saying to the world that Iran is able, capable of doing what they've been saying that they are the only ones that are capable of doing, that if they don't exist, then there's no security in the seas. But Iran is showing that, yes, when you, even if they're not there, Iran can give the security to that region of the world, that very important strategic region of the world. Did I understand correctly what you're saying?
Okay, here I would like to draw your attention to the fact that this growth is realized step by step. In the first step, we have an order that the security of Iran's shipping lines should be maintained. When you have presence in a region and you establish security for yourself, the whole region benefits from that security. In the big picture, this security expands its borders. That is, in fact, the country of Iran has gifted this security to the world because the ships of all countries of the world pass through this area.
So in other words, what you're saying is that we are hitting the very basic argument that they have been making for over 100 years, which is that we are the ones that give security, naval and marine and security on the seas. And yet Iran has now come into the scene and is saying to them and to the world that there's no need for the Americans or for the Westerners to be here. We, as a local nation, as a local power, are able to give this security not only for ourselves but for the whole world, and there's no need for these foreigners to come from tens of thousands of miles away to do this. Did I understand this correctly?
Yes, it is exactly the same, but I want to share a point with you. During this period, since 2009, we have convoyed more than 5,000 ships belonging to the Islamic Republic. We had more than 200 direct clashes with pirates. It is interesting for you to know that among the 20 ships we saved, one belonged to the Americans, and they asked us for help. The help request was actually in an area where they claimed to be present. You correctly used the word lie, but I say a monstrous lie. Claiming that they want to establish security is not a white lie, but a bare-faced big lie. They were not even able to help their own ship. They didn't help other ships either. In one case, they had a clash with pirates in which members from both their own forces and the crew of the ship they were trying to save were killed. But the Iranian Navy had two direct skirmishes without a single casualty. We have had more than 200 clashes to this day. But would it not hurt even one pirate? Because in our opinion, these are not thieves. These are poor people who are being abused. And it is necessary for the people of the world to know that we arrested a number of pirates in one of the naval operations against pirates when we saved a Chinese vessel. But would it not take these arrested thieves or pirates to Guantanamo to perform immoral and inhumane experiments on them? They are human beings like us. So they all came to the Islamic Republic of Iran and took training courses and learned jobs. Then they returned to their own countries and engaged in various professions, including carpentry and tailoring, and the jobs they were able to do, including mechanics and the fields that they were interested in, such as handicrafts. Today, those people are no longer thieves. I would like to share with you another point. Pay attention to these people who are stealing in the sea now. What kind of people are they? These are all Muslims. Our enemy wants to show the world that Muslims do not have the ability to govern themselves and therefore they commit crimes. But it's wrong. Muslims have many abilities. But unfortunately, they've been oppressed and they've been in a situation where they had to engage in a piracy. Now, what is the result of Iran's efforts? What happened? We were encouraged and appreciated in several stages, both in writings and at various meetings. But for what reason? Because although we had came to establish security and safety for our vessels, and we have always said, not changing slogans, that this region has the capacity and capability and that the countries of the region can reject foreign forces and establish security together hand in hand. Here I feel a need to emphasize again that their ships also pass through this safe area. But nevertheless, they try to make it look unsafe in various ways. Well, here, as you said, a naval power has come to the scene. But this naval power today does not intend to boast about its capabilities. This is not our basis. The basis of our work is in the form of maritime or defense diplomacy. We carry the Iranian flag and proudly wave it in the seas and sail and defend the countries of the region. We pay visits to them and show our capabilities and deliver this message to all of them.
That's very interesting, Admiral. So I want to move a little bit further away from our own area, where you talked about the northern Indian Ocean. You talked about this area that we've been able to really establish security here without the need for any foreign powers. But we've also witnessed and we've also seen that the Iranian Navy is moving in all areas of the world. We've had the very famous and important mission to the Caribbean Sea and towards the Atlantic Ocean in Venezuela, which was, of course, everybody in the world was astonished to see that Iran was able to do this. We had the trip to St. Petersburg, which it went through the Mediterranean and up through the English Channel and towards the North Sea. Of course, we had some years back the mission that you were the commander of going through the Suez Canal for the first time in many years for the Iranian Navy and going into the Eastern Mediterranean. And also we see recently now that a naval group is going towards the east, the Straits of Malacca, Indonesia, and on to other areas. So if you could please briefly give us some details about every one of these missions and if there's anything in the future that we have plans for.
خدمتتون عرض بکنم که من یه کوچولو توضیح بدم که ما یک اجلاس فرماندهان حاشیه اقیانوس هند داریم در با عنوان آیاز مخففشه.
You may want to know that there is an initiative named Indian Ocean Naval Symposium, which includes three working groups: the Maritime Security Group, the Humanitarian Assistance and Disaster Relief Group, and finally the Information Sharing and Interoperability Group. Due to our maritime activities during this period, we have the honor of chairing two working groups, which in fact are the most important ones: the Maritime Security Group, in which most countries are members, and the Humanitarian Assistance and Disaster Relief Group, which is relevant to the whole world. But on the issue you mentioned, I said that we used the advantage of access. We felt the need to go further and experience other sea and ocean areas. After all, we are sailors. We have the equipment. We also have the science. Well, you should know that when we were invited to attend an official ceremony in St. Petersburg, in respect to this invitation, we sailed this route steadfastly. During this period, we were subjected to numerous negative propaganda campaigns from the enemy. They spread lies against our navy, claiming that we intend to make the region insecure, sell weapons and deliver arms, but we did not enter any country or dock at any port except St. Petersburg. Our navy sailed 45,000 kilometers and crossed two or three oceans and seas. We crossed all those canals and waterways you mentioned and arrived at St. Petersburg, participated in the ceremony, and then returned. Our fleet proudly crossed the Suez Canal and returned to the country. Today, yes, we are present in the Straits of Malacca because our vessels are moving there. We will cover and convoy our ships every day. Well, it was a question for everyone whether the Iranian Navy has this ability and how it acquired this ability. Let me tell you a memory from this trip. During this trip, I experienced the hardest and most terrible storms that I had seen in all my years of sailing. A strong wind with speeds up to 160 kilometers per hour affected us for 8 days. The strength of the sea storms was so high that no vessel could sail nearby. No one. For all the countries there, it was surprising how the Iranian Navy was able to sail sustainably in this Mediterranean environment and in this very rough sea. We stayed there until the day the sea calmed down and displayed our sea prowess and then returned. Regarding the future, as you mentioned, this is our basis. Our basis is diplomacy. Our basis is friendship. Our basis is the exchange of capabilities. Our basis is not empty promises, and we never intend to boast. All the countries of the world have this will and power, but they should make an effort and be present in the sea themselves, and they can establish their own security. But here, because it is a region that belongs to different countries, our presence doesn't mean that others do not need to be present. The difference between the discourse of the Islamic Republic and the West is that we have always said that we would like to establish the security of the region with the cooperation of other countries. But they say that the security of the region can only be achieved by themselves, and that they only want to plunder our resources. See how different the discourse is? Iranians have a very rich and humanitarian culture. We have the highest respect for the human being that God created and brought on earth, and this is a lesson. It will be the same in the future, and we'll be present in the sea with more modern facilities. Today, our people are demanding this because their knowledge has increased, their technology has increased, and our youth are proudly struggling day and night to see their soldiers in the sea more firmly and with more authority.
سربازانشون رو در دریا استوارتر و با اقتدار بیشتری شاهد باشه.
It's interesting that you're mentioning that we've really gone in all various directions now and are present there, as you said, of course, in terms of showing our presence and going there in peace and trying to establish friendly relations with friendly nations who exist around the world. My question is this, are we going to maybe see in the future a time when the Navy of the Islamic Republic goes into the Pacific Ocean, maybe goes through the Panama Canal, goes through some of the countries that are maybe considered countries that they wouldn't have even dreamed of one day that the Iranian Navy would be passing by them? Is there anything in the future that you can tell us in this regard?
I want to deliver this message to all the people of the world that Iranians are very peaceful people with a humanitarian culture, and our country is not vulnerable despite all the conspiracies and efforts made by the distant enemy to harm it. The people of the world should know that if they are stuck in the middle of the seas in any way, the Iranian Navy will surely come to the rescue, even in the depths of the seas.
At the end of our conversation, I would like to ask you a question a bit more personal regarding your own life and the path you have taken in your own life. As you know, there have been issues now in Iran, and also this has been unfortunately exploited by our enemies, talking about the different ethnic groups that live in Iran. Of course, those of us who live in Iran know that none of that is true, that we live in peace here. All the different ethnic groups live in peace in Iran and are brothers and sisters of each other, and some of the things that are said are basic lies about what the reality is in Iran. You yourself were born in the beautiful province of Kurdistan, and it's very interesting, I think, for our audience to hear what happened in your own life. Kurdistan is very far from the sea. It's not a coastal area. It's actually a mountainous area, very far from the sea. So how is it that a young man from Kurdistan comes towards the sea and ends up being the commander of the Navy of the Islamic Republic of Iran?
First of all, I would like to use this opportunity to extend my blessings and appreciation to Iranian Kurds, my fellow citizens, and thank them for not being deceived by the enemy. This issue is not only limited to this day, but for decades the enemy has been trying to abuse this issue of ethnic tension and create discord. Of course, it is not only the issue of ethnic differences, but the enemy also tries to create divisions within the country through sowing discord among Shias and Sunnis. All the efforts by the enemies to create unrest in Iran at the borders have so far failed, thanks to the unity that exists among the different ethnic groups who live in the border areas. Therefore, I would like to extend my warmest greetings and appreciation to all of them. And finally, about myself, I must say that during the war, my father fought on land against the enemy aggression, but I myself was interested in experiencing new environments since my childhood, and I had a special interest in the sea. My dream was to sail across the Indian Ocean someday and reach Australia. When I finished high school, one day I came across a Navy ad on TV. The advertisement went like this: join the Navy and see the world. Well, it was a difficult decision, you're right. Someone who is thousands of kilometers away from the sea now wants to go and experience an environment that he has no knowledge of. Perhaps our only experience with water was the public pools where we swam. In any case, I entered because of my initial interest. At that time, the issue of naval war was not discussed much in the newspapers, because in the first 6 to 7 days of the war, the maritime clash was actually over. I was interested to know more about naval war. Therefore, I entered the Imam Khomeini Naval University of Nowshahr and completed my bachelor's degree specializing in navigation and ship command, and then went to the southern coast, and as time passed, my interest in the sea grew deeper. There's a saying among sailors which says, the sea is such that going in is in the hands of the captain, but returning is in the hands of God. At sea, whether you like it or not, you will be directly connected with God. Well, I continued this path in my life, and today, for me as a Kurd who has come from the western part of the vast and beloved country of Iran, it is a great honor that the leader Ayatollah Khamenei found me trustworthy and entrusted me with the Islamic Republic of Iran's strategic navy, which is completely equipment-oriented. My comrades are special and very distinguished. From here, I send my gratitude to them all and kiss their hands in appreciation of their constant efforts to properly display the dimensions of Iran's authority at sea. I think I gave the necessary explanations, but if there is any question, I'm at your service.
Admiral Irani, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. And if there's anything else you would like to tell us, if there's anything left out that you didn't want, that didn't have a chance to say, please, we have a few minutes left.
As you mentioned, we have the experience of dispatching naval fleet from the west to Venezuela and the Caribbean coast. So we've been there before, and we have convoyed our ships. As a result, I believe we will be definitely invited and will not reject any invitation because we want this friendly relationship and mutual respect to be stable. We will definitely attend because we see no limitations. And hopefully, if the countries of South and Central America invite us, we will definitely be proud to attend and we will be happy to have maritime relations with those dear ones.
Thank you so much for joining us on Insight. So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Admiral Irani? Despite the massive advancements in aerospace technology that humanity has experienced in the last century, the oceans and the sea remain the dominant form of economic and commercial interaction among humanity. And the existence of naval capabilities remains a vital necessity for most nations. Ancient nations with ancient naval traditions, such as Iran, were not allowed to develop their naval capabilities in the era of Anglo-American global naval dominance in the 19th and 20th century. Particularly in West Asia, the geostrategically most important region of the world. Following the Islamic Revolution and the imposed war, Iran began to gradually develop its navy into a strategic force which today is providing maritime security in the region and flying the flag in distant seas from Latin America to Northern Europe to East Asia. This is a result of the general awakening of the Iranian nation following the Islamic Revolution, which has resulted in Iran rapidly advancing in all social, political, economic, technological, scientific, and military fields, including naval power. Iran is establishing a permanent naval presence in the world's oceans and seas in cooperation with its strategic partners from around the world, with a focus on joint security and naval diplomacy, but also power projection when necessary. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Belgian police have made six arrests and seized mobile phones, computers and €600,000 in cash in connection with a corruption scandal at the European Parliament. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Euronews has covered this story and gives us more details. Four people have been charged in connection with an anti-corruption investigation into the European Parliament that has sent shockwaves throughout Brussels. European Parliament Vice President Eva Kaili and three others were charged and imprisoned on Sunday, 11th of December in Belgium, amid a police probe into alleged corruption linked with Qatar. Six people have been arrested since Friday, 9th of December, in Brussels, after investigators made multiple raids based on suspicions of substantial money payments by the Persian Gulf state of Qatar to influence members of the European Parliament MEPs. Eva Kaili, a Greek socialist MEP and one of 14 vice presidents at the European Legislative Body, was charged with corruption. She has been suspended from her party and sanctioned, being withdrawn from duties such as representing the head of the parliament in the Middle East. The Belgian Federal Prosecutor's Office did not name the country, but a source close to the issue confirmed to Agence France-Presse that it was Qatar,